This programme is made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland Sound and Vision Scheme through the television licence fee.
Diagwich, agus falcha go the word. I'm Max Hendrickson.
And I'm Luke Hanley.
And we'll be presenting today's programme.
Welcome to the third and final part of the Word radio series broadcast here on Near FM.
So many fantastic stories and poems, and so little time to bring them to you.
Well, let's get the show on the road with this extremely thought-provoking story.
Feature article by Emma Kelly. Read by Emily Tierney Kinsler. Copy and paste your face. How do you feel about your face being digitally copied so realistically that you can't tell the difference? Since deepfake has become the prominence in 2017, we have already seen Mark Zuckerberg brag about having total control over billions of people's stolen data, and witnessed Jon Snow's moving apology for the dismissal ending to the Game of Thrones, and watched Barack Obama insult Donald Trump multiple times in a speech. Deepfakes are false videos created by digital software, machine learning, and face swapping. The term deepfake itself comes from the underlying technology, deep learning, which is a form of AI. Deep learning algorithms, which teach themselves how to solve problems when given large sets of data, are used to swap faces in videos and digital content to make realistic-looking fake media. I think deepfake is a big milestone in the world of technology and a great achievement for those who have helped to develop it. It would be fun to have a celebrity dancing around or telling jokes, if used responsibly. It can be. Although without a proper, efficient way to control it, or even in the wrong hands, deepfake can be catastrophic and would cause more damage than it would good.
We'll continue with our stories for the moment.
Truly Haunted by Keith Cummins, read by Natalia Brodish. Once there was a boy named Oscar who arranged to go to a haunted house, half an hour away from their street. 2 days later, they all walked to the haunted house on their way. There, they had to walk through a forest. While they were walking, they heard strange noises coming from behind trees. Eventually, they saw the house. It was old, broken down, and the paint that was on the house was almost completely washed off. It started to rain, so they all ran inside and came across a sitting room. The only pieces of furniture in the room were a rocking chair and a table with burnt-out candles. Lauren, one of Oscar's friends, was scared and wanted to leave. However, Aaron and Ross convinced her to stay. Then they started to walk upstairs, and Aaron saw a shadow of a crooked old man. He asked the others if anyone else saw it, but they all said no. They continued to walk down the hallway. They seen a door, so they walked through it. Then it slammed shut, and Lauren fell through a weak piece of wood. She fell on the downstairs floor, which was made of hard tiles, and she died. The others tried to open the door, but it didn't open. Then they saw a lanky, long man crawl out of the hole Lauren fell through. They all ran to a vent on the back wall, and Oscar crawled through first. Then Aaron, and then Ross started to go through, but his leg got grabbed and was eaten by the tall man. After running down the stairs, they saw a door with a window on it. They opened it and were glad to see the forest. They ran away from the house and back into their street. They called the police and showed them the location, only to find there was no house, only a pile of muck and leaves.
Excellent. How about a couple of poems?
One Last Embrace by Abigail Doherty. In loving memory of my Nan. Over a year since you've left, each tear I've shed and wept, not so much as a sound in your house, not even the squeak of a little mouse. It's not the same, dear, now you're gone. Your room is empty, dusk till dawn. I remember the days we would laugh and smile and think it's been a while. Each morning I'd wake up and make your tea. Not a drop of tea made since you've left me. I think of you each night and day, and the memory of us on that summer's day. So truthful and kind, the way that you were designed, so little as a blanket left behind. I miss your smell, your touch, your face. I miss being in your company and space. Oh, so much I would do for one last embrace.
We are heading out and about today with our first poem, Asquelga.
Maxhul Lahareed Shahzad, read by Olive Angulo. Tay Maxhul Sheiklug. Angui Eksheda Maig. Dunam Mahula Augustoga Manal. Klesum Nahain Ekana Amron. Tanakran Ek Rinka Sagui. Augustrukag Nablahana Part Iglahug. Blahana Eksheda Trasna Maig. August Yalan Nadiloga Fui Mahosa. Tanahain Egbigal. Tanagdiloga Ekshias Ernak. Tanahiri Egrasyakt. August Tana Behak Egbumal. Duskal me Masula. Egfak me Efekal. August Lan me Mahuloid. Ischig San Forsa.
I like this poem.
Copycat by Lucy Galligan. It's hard being me. I'm like no other, you see. But being an individual is important to feel free. Don't you dye your hair. I sigh with a stare. Why do you care? This is just unfair. Is it distracting to pupils or really just your disapproval? I'm very different, you see. But that's not what's important to me. No piercings allowed, once again changing myself to suit your town. I will not salute this copycat troop or join your group. I want to be me. I am my dyed hair, even though it might be rare and you might want to stare. So don't try and take my uniqueness away. I'm going to continue to be me every day.
This is a good time for a story, Asquelga.
Anytime is a good time for a story, Asquelga.
Ia hauna lahana grey, read by Olive Angulo. Ia hauna awan, vi chok kapta sequil, vi she on spotrock. Vi she mordon, agus morgyok, rent bali brishta. Is shig, vi karnavalok typesha agus zombies, vi tree typesha bert, kalini, ag bukul awan. Vi sula gurum afyun, egon kalin, awan, agus vi she ard. Visula glossa grug, sincer eg on dini ella, agus vise bjog freshen. Vigurig agus sula dun eron bukul, agus vi shakt kunavrlok on. Spree rock on tulug, sashomra, si brista on finyog, agus vi skulatana nabale. Brishti urlar on shomra folka, brishti on skihon nur. Usrig on dirtle, agus vi on lehris eron dien. Uskligli ein kyaun de duris, siomra lapa agus so lauerlon, vi gokrod dien, agus vi gov baon.
Now our next story is on a very important subject, and surprisingly we've gotten a number of stories and poems on the subject. So it was down to blind choice as to which piece would be included in the series.
Please Pick Up by Niall Finnegan. Read by Luke Hanley. The sun shone solemnly, alone in the light blue sky, casting its light upon the dew-sodden grass. The sun pierced its rays through the high-topped trees, dotting the ground below. Out from behind these trees came the darkly dressed bodies. Following the crunchy gravel path, they emerged out into the open space. Some walked alone, hands buried deep in their pockets. Their faces drooped with grief, others walked together, no words being exchanged. The presence of another person was enough comfort for them. Declan was the last of these broken people to egress from the tree line. He ran his dark leather shoes through the dewed grass plaintively. Droplets ran down the side of his shoes like tears. He looked up with his raw red eyes and searched for her. Declan made eye contact with Aisling. She threw a sideways glance beside her, and then back at him. Declan nodded, accepting the invitation. He walked over, brushing past people awkwardly, giving those he knew a weak smile. He reached her and stood beside her. They faced the grave together. She reached out her hand, and Declan accepted, locking their fingers together. Declan couldn't look at the grave. Instead, he held his head upwards, attempting to assuage his grief. His stomach was churning, yet he felt vacant. Something was missing, and he so desperately yearned for it. He wanted his friend to come back. Noah's name reverberated through Declan's body, causing him to inhale unexpectedly. Declan clenched his teeth hard into his lower jaw. "Don't you dare cry, Declan," he thought desperately. "Stopping such a wimp, man up." Declan let out a slow, shaky breath and cleared his throat. The golden brown coffin then came into view. Declan watched it make its way up the gravel path, upon the backs of the most broken people. Declan should be helping. He should be there, carrying his friend. People parted to either side of the grave to allow the coffin through. Declan didn't like this. It was so unfair. What had the guard you told him again? An unfortunate mixture of alcohol and drugs? That just wasn't like Noah. He died in the bathroom with people gathered around him thinking he had just passed out. Why had no one called an ambulance sooner? It was what he would have done. It was what he should have done, if only he'd gone to the party. Noah pleaded with him to go. He strongly refused. "I don't go to these things, Noah," he had said. "You know me. I'm not good with people." But he knew, deep down, he would have been fine. Declan didn't notice the priest had already begun the service. The pallbearers were getting ready to lower the coffin into the grave. Declan squeezed Aisling's hand tight. "This isn't right," Declan thought, helplessly. As the coffin got lowered into the ground, Declan's heart felt like it was seeping down with it. When the coffin finally rested at the bottom, Declan's tears fell, mixing with the dewy grass beneath his feet. People stood around the grave for a while, giving their condolences to the family or saying their last prayer until they slipped away slowly back into their cars. Declan and Aisling were eventually the only ones left. "Come on, Declan, we better be going. They said to be at the hotel for two," Aisling said, as gently as she could. Declan nodded. He had composed himself. He would feel better later on, Declan thought. He just needed some warm food to soothe himself, and maybe some alcohol. He always opted not to drink whenever he went out, but by God was he desperate to numb it all. To wake up tomorrow with no recollection of today. Aisling turned away to leave. There was the noise of someone's crunching footsteps upon the gravel path beginning to grow louder in Declan's ear. He turned around to stand with Aisling. A girl, who wore a long grey coat with small black boots, was making her way towards them. Her long brunette hair swayed from side to side as she marched up the gravel path. "Who's that?" asked Aisling, still watching her approach them. I have no idea," answered Declan, cluelessly. Eventually, the girl reached them. Declan could see she was hurting like the rest of them, but there was rage behind her eyes, and they were sharply pinned on him. "Are you Declan?" she said, forcefully. "Yeah, that's me," Declan said, confused. She nodded, tight-lipped, before abruptly shoving Declan to the ground, inches away from the grave. "Why didn't you pick up your phone?" she shrieked. "Why the hell didn't you answer his call?" she said through gritted teeth, pointing at Noah's gravestone. Aisling held the girl back firmly and prevented her from advancing on Declan. "What are you talking about? Who are you?" Declan said in a panicked voice. "I'm Sarah. I was his girlfriend." Declan laid on the ground, dumbfounded. Noah had never mentioned a girlfriend to him. "He never mentioned you before," Declan said in a calmer tone. "We'd only been going out for a month. We wanted to keep things quiet," she trailed off as she looked at Noah's gravestone. Declan began to get up before she stormed at him again. "You still haven't answered my question," she bellowed. Declan staggered back and waited for Aisling to grab hold of her again. "I've no idea what phone call you're talking about," Declan pleaded. "I wasn't even on my phone that night. I was watching a movie with my family." However, Declan knew exactly what she was talking about. The one that vibrated on his study desk. The one he looked at and saw Noah's name. The one he ignored. They had gotten into a fight earlier on the phone. Noah had called him an attention seeker, self-centered and weak, all because he didn't want to go to the party. Declan couldn't control his rage and spitted out his own venomous words targeted at Noah's sensitive past. Declan was in no mood to talk to him when he called later that night, so he allowed it to ring out in his hand, letting out a short, smug laugh when it stopped ringing. "Why didn't you just go to that stupid party?" Sarah said bitterly. Declan's chest tightened and he felt the blood drain it from his face. "The last text I got from him was saying that you weren't answering him. In the end, I was the one that rang the guardie. I knew something was wrong," she said, her voice getting low. The three of them stood in silence. The distant sound of cars rolling out of the car park was the only noise that lingered in the air. "I'm so sorry. If I'd seen the call..." Declan cleared his throat. He was getting awfully anxious. "I would have answered. My phone didn't even register a missed call as well." "I'm so sorry," Declan said, keeping the nerves from creeping into his voice. Sarah nodded respectfully. She opened her mouth to say something, but soon closed it, staring at the ground. Tears began to fill Sarah's eyes, and she turned her head away in shame. "I'm sorry," she whispered, before turning her back to Declan and quickly retreating down the gravel path. Aisling and Declan watched her disappear behind the many trees that guarded this graveyard. Declan felt sick. He could feel his body giving up on him, his joints and muscles becoming weak. "Let's go," he said with a shaky voice, walking past Aisling. "Declan?" Aisling said, concern coming through her voice. Declan stopped and wrapped his coat tightly around himself. Suddenly he felt cold. "What's up?" he answered, turning around with a weak smile. "I remember you telling me," she said, making sure that she said each word carefully, "that you and Declan got into a fight that day." Her tone had become completely serious. "Please tell me, did you or did you not see your phone ringing?" she asked, her eyes wide, looking into his. "No," Declan said. "I didn't see the call, Aisling, honestly." Aisling nodded while looking back at Noah's grave. "Okay," she said, awkwardly giving him a smile. "Let's head back to my car then," she said, brushing past him and folding her arms over her chest. Declan stood there awkwardly for a moment. He took a step back to take a look at Noah one last time, but stopped himself. Guilt struck his gut and rippled around his body. Starting with small shovels, Declan began to walk away from the grave. The sun had disappeared behind a cloud, and the trees had become far less inviting compared to when everyone had first entered the graveyard. Declan walked hurriedly down the straight gravel path alone, the warm comfort of sun absent on his back.
A tough subject, Luke. The title says it all.
Yeah, but it's a subject that needs to be addressed. If you don't feel good in yourself, please, please talk to someone about it.
Always remember, you are not alone, you are loved, you are wanted, and you are needed.
That's so true, and there's always help out there.
That's a good thing to remember.
Let's take some more poems.
My Love Departed, by Charlie Doyle.
Read by Emily Tierney Kinsler.
'Twas a mild summer's eve the day I met you. At first I felt about you that which I feel about most individuals. Indifference. But after a while in your company, I felt within myself a different emotion. New, strange, scary. I dismissed those feelings as but fleeting thoughts. Needless to say, they were not. Every time you entered a room, I'd feel butterflies at the quickest glance of your smile, your eyes. We have a similar outlook on life and near same stories to tell, but we were different enough that each time we spoke, it was a first experience, something thrilling and new. It was a huge mistake to grow so attached to you, knowing that one day I would have to leave and never see you again. But I pushed that knowledge out of my mind. If the day wasn't close, it wasn't real. It wasn't ready to never see you again. Your smile, your eyes. My heart aches because you were my first love and my first heartbreak, and you didn't even know.
Zombieland by Adam Belton. Dear Diary, today is the second day of the zombie apocalypse. Me and my mom met up with some other survivors, James, Reese, and Ryan. They told us that they were heading up north because there was a survivor shelter, but they will need to figure out how to get past all the zombies. We were going to throw a pot down and create a distraction, so the zombies would be distracted. So, as it fell, we ran for a nearby Mustang. It had no fuel, so we needed to locate a nearby gas station, but then the zombies noticed we were there and ran at us. We ran as fast as we could to get to the gas station, and it was all boarded up. So we went around the back, and there was guns and food stashed. We got the guns and shot everything, and then we saw it until it was dead. There was a car hooked up to the gas station, so we filled it up and took it. We got in and headed north to the shelter. An hour later, we finally arrived, and there were soldiers everywhere and were heavily armed. As we came up, they tested our temperatures. We were all okay, so we headed in and there were beds and people everywhere. We went over to see new beds and got some pasta. As we were eating, we noticed a man coughing and who looked really sick, so we wanted to keep our distance. We went to bed and we were woken up to screaming that had been an outbreak and there was infected everywhere. So we rushed out and got in our car and the soldiers were shooting everything and everyone, so we got out of there in a split second. We wanted to find a house in the countryside, so as we were driving, we were half asleep, but we were almost there. We finally arrived and there was a farmer growing crops, so we pulled in to see what was happening, and he said he'd been living in the countryside his whole life and was hiding away from the infected. He let us stay in the barn that night, and we went to sleep in the soft hay. The next morning we had fresh eggs for our breakfast, and after he asked us for help with growing the crops, we got in a tractor and started harvesting them. After an hour, we finally finished. Then we fed the chickens, fed the cows, fed the pigs, then fed the sheep. And we had our dinner, which was vegetable stew. While we were eating, we thanked the man for letting us stay, and he said we were a great help and it was a pleasure. After we were wrecked, we went over to the barn and he gave us a land of a mattress. So we got under the covers and we were happy to be alive for another day.
I think we'll have another poem before we go to our feature story.
Maybe, by Hannah McDermott. What even is love, in anyways? I'm too young to be thinking about that. When have I ever acted my age? So what is it? Is it a hug from your ma when everything's gone to shit? When your little cousins run up to you every time they see you? Is it your mates always being there to kick about when things are rough in the gaff? Is it the teachers that ask how things when you look like death's ugly cousin? A text from your mate about how this reminded me of you? Is it a head on a shoulder on a long bus home? Or your little sister asking you to play with her and her little friends, because even though she's only a bloody young one, she knows how lonely things can get? Is it a hand held or a shoulder bumped down in the old scout hall? Is it the pat on the back from your dad when you score, even when you don't? Is it a giggle from across the room, or a cheeky wink from that one cracker? Was it when your uncle taught you how to ride a bike, and then took you cycling whenever he could, because he knew it wasn't something that anyone else would do with you? Is it when the snotty 13-year-old, who won't tell his ma he loves her, shouts love you out the door because he knows you're both growing up and away there might not be many left? Maybe. Maybe it is these things. Maybe it's not. It might be none of them, but I think I'd be happy if it is, because these are bloody lovely and they're what makes us us. Maybe. But I'm too young to know in any ways, so what can I say?
Brilliant. We are heading back in time with this week's feature story. Malaga is by Ben, a pupil from Man Temple Comprehensive School.
Malaga by Ben, read by Luke Hanley. In the year of 1438, we set sail from the city of Malaga in the south on our expedition to explore deeper into the new world. Well, that was the plan. No one was really sure where we ended up. I was a crew member, one of nearly 60 aboard the SS Morgan on that fateful voyage. Our captain, old Michael G. Scott, was an old, ugly-looking man with a broad face and big, scary eyes that could burn a hole in the back of our head. He had a big, bushy beard that covered the whole lower part of his face. He was a miserable old git, and the whole crew hated him. He would sit in his cabin all day and night, only come out to bark at us for not doing our jobs properly. I didn't know it when we set off, but he would have a huge influence on a lot of my crewmates' lives on that voyage. We were somewhere in the Atlantic Ocean, we thought, when we stopped for the night, because it was getting so dark that you couldn't see 3 feet in front of you. There was mist in the air, which made it even more difficult to see. Suddenly we hear a loud thump coming from the right side of the ship, and we came to a sharp halt. Out came Captain Scott, shouting, "What the bloody hell was that?" He still had breadcrumbs in his beard from whatever he had for lunch. "Captain," came a shout from above, from the man taking watch on top of the mast. "We seem to have hit a tree or something." On came the headlight, pointing over to the point where we were hit. Everybody gathered around where the crash happened. "That's a tree, all right," said one of the crew members. The cut into the side of the ship was deep, about 3 feet into the side of it. There was no getting out of this one. "What are we going to do, Captain?" said Bucky behind my shoulder. "I'm going to bed. All you thick skulls got us into this mess. You're going to get us out of it." As he was saying that, I could feel water soaking into my boots, as did everyone. "We're sinking," said Bucky, in a panic. "Abandon ship." Absolute chaos ensued when some people jumped overboard. Others started climbing up the mast and onto the sails. The rest ran to the spare lifeboats and piled on as many as could fit, including me. But Captain Scott ran back into his cabin and slammed the door shut. "Come on, Captain, there's room here for you," shouted one man from my lifeboat. Out he came, running, rucksack in hand. The water was filling up fast. It was nearly up to his waist, which made it difficult for him to run. I didn't hesitate to unhook the boat and row away. He was taking too long. I had to, or else we would all have died. I took the decision to choose us over him, and I do not regret it. I never saw some of my crewmates and very close friends again after that day. There was 12 of us on that lifeboat, which was only built to hold 8, so things were very cramped. We had no food and about 5 canteens of water between us. We had no idea where we were or where we were going. We were out at sea for less than 24 hours before our first casualty. He died of hunger because the conditions were already harsh enough on the ship. I was lucky as I just had a meal before we crashed. But he would not be the last to go because the next day, 2 other men didn't wake up from their sleep. It took us 2 days at sea to find any signs of life where we ran into another lifeboat from our ship with only 3 people left. They gave the nine of us some food and water to keep us going, and we parted ways. We were rowing and rowing for days, with what little food we had left, until we encountered something very familiar. We saw it from a distance, so we approached then. As we got closer, it became clear what it was. We were back where we started. The tree that caused all of this. That caused our ship to crash. That caused us to lose countless men, including our captain. Just sticking up above the water, completely oblivious of what it had caused. From a distance, there was no sign of what had happened, but as we got closer, evidence emerged in the form of floating planks of wood and pieces of fabric from the sail. Some floating clothes and hats, but no signs of life, no movement at all. Everything was completely still as we rowed through and continued our search for rescue. There was only seven of us left on our lifeboat now. One died of a tetanus infection he got from a hook while trying to fish. The other killed himself because he couldn't take another day out here. I stood up after a long night of swaying with the rough waves of the Atlantic Sea and the bitter coldness of a winter's night. I stretched every muscle I had left in my body and let out a big, hungry yawn, but it was cut short by my relief as I saw a boat sailing slowly into the horizon. I woke up the men, and they were all just as relieved as I was. We were all exhausted and starving, so we decided that the best thing to do was to chase the boat and pursue rescue. We were less than a mile away from the boat now, that close to rescue. We've been rowing for about a day and a half now, non-stop. We ate the last of our food that night, and we were starving. As we approached the ship, it looked much, much bigger. It seemed to stop as we got closer and closer. We could see a figure coming out onto the deck and looking over the side at us through a telescope. I stood and waved my hands around so that they knew we meant no harm. "You seem to be lost," we heard the figure shouting over to us. "Our ship sank. We've been out here for 2 weeks. Can you help us?" replied one of my companions. "Aye," he shouted. "Permission to board." We were all very relieved when we got aboard. We got food and water and our first good night's sleep in weeks. The boat brought us back to Spain and we all got on with our lives. As far as I know, the only survivors of that voyage were us seven on that lifeboat. We were blessed. That was the last voyage I ever went on. I took up a new career as a craftsman in Seville, in Spain, and started a family. I've never forgotten, nor will I ever forget about that voyage, and about what I did to Captain Scott. I had to do what I did, or we wouldn't have survived. I do not regret the decision I made. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today.
Don't forget to check out the Near FM website for full details on The Word. And of course, you can download a podcast of all the programs in The Word series from the website.
We hope you enjoyed the series and wish to thank everyone who made it possible. It's been a fantastic showcase of Irish literary talent. We'd like to thank everyone who sent in a story or poem for the series.
We are sincerely sorry that we couldn't have included more of your work, as each and every piece deserved to be heard. Such great material in so little time.
We would like to thank all the teachers who guided us through this project in these challenging times. We are lucky to have you.
The Word Radio Series is produced by Enda M. Roach and is a Pearlman Media production for Near FM. So from myself, Max Hendrickson.
And myself, Luke Hanley.
Until next time.
Slangefall.